Heidi Holton, thanks for choosing this KAXE KBXE conversation. We are member-supported radio, a National Public Radio affiliate in northern Minnesota. We need your support for our radio broadcasts, our online content, and our podcast. Go to KAXE.org, and thanks for listening. This is the extra podcast edition of the Dig Deep conversation that happened because there was no debate for the governor candidate.
So this is the one where we can swear, right?
Yeah,
no, I'm kidding.
We can, actually.
Well, no,
yeah.
I'm not going to swear.
But we're not swearers. We wouldn't do that.
So,
but yeah, you wanted to break, let's where do we want to go? Where do we want to start? You wanted to push back a little bit here at Aaron.
So I when I was on vacation, read Nassim Taleb, who's my favorite author today, my favorite thinker. He wrote a book called The Black Swan and Anti-Fragile. And really, like, these books were early, helped me think through a lot of things that I was struggling with. His latest book's called Skin in the Game. And it's really interesting because he makes the point, and I think he is right, that when it comes to Trump, the president shares one characteristic with a lot of the, you know, what you kind of referred to, Aaron, as the aggrieved, the working poor, what have you. And that is that he was subjected to failure. The left likes to show Donald Trump, and there's this one photo that was passed around during the last election with like a meme, like, so this is the common man. And it's him like in some big palatial suite on some throne
with
like a lion. Yeah, yeah. His apartment. Right. No, like gold all over his model wife there, you know, his whatever. And it's like, so this is your man, like this is your like man of the people. And there's a certain like, you know, you're just measuring like the outcomes. Taleb makes the case, and I think he's right, that anyone who's subjected themselves to the idea that they could lose billions, like lose $1 billion, which at one point Trump was totally broke, and Hillary Clinton made a big deal out of that. The Democrats made a big deal of that in the last presidential election. Like, you really want, this is a guy who's, you know, was flat broke and needed. You know what? I actually think that Americans and humans in general have more respect for the person who can make huge gains, who also exposes themselves to huge loss, than the person who can just like sit and basically have like the very comfortable, secure living. And I'll contrast, I'll use the college professor as like the moniker, not to pick on my buddy here. But I'll use that as like
you're really winding me up here, Chuck.
But I'll use that as a personification. A college professor is never going to be rich. College professors are never going to sit in like a palatial estate and have, you know, lions and gold and throne and what have you. It's not going to happen because
I have something I call a throne.
No, I know you do. And I appreciate
But when
that.
The Vic Power book comes out, you never know.
Maybe, right. Maybe then it all changes. But, you know, the college professor is never going to end up there. But the college professor is never going to end up destitute either, unless they like do something that they shouldn't do. But you know, you've got steady, reliable income, you've got job security, you've not, in a sense, and I don't say this to be offensive, you have, in a sense, like risked it all. And if you live on the margins of society, your daily experience is risking it all. Your daily experience is like, I at any point could be in ruin. And I think that the connection between, I think that the left of this country misunderstands the Trump phenomena when they look at his billions and say, how can this guy represent the common man? He represents common man because he has been willing to, in a sense, run the risk of losing it all. Where, you know, a vast majority of the comfortable, what I think working people look at as like the elite in this country, are not at that same level of risk of essentially like not having enough, not, you know, risk of losing what they have tomorrow. Aaron.
Yeah.
So one of the things I would point out is that when Trump inherited his, he says there's varying accounts, $1 million.
Millions. I mean, let's say it's tens of millions, hundreds of millions, whatever
he says less, and I'll give him that credit. Maybe it was less than $10 million, but it was certainly more than $1 million. Back in the 70s when he started out, had he gone about a fairly conservative, I mean small c conservative you know, method of investing that money, he would have more money now than he has. And the reality is he is part of a system, a classically American system that has allowed him, he's been allowed to fail with relative impunity. He's never had to move out of his gold apartment. He's never had to, you know, deal with actually losing it all. He's had to deal with public humiliation, and he handles that like Muhammad Ali of that, because he doesn't feel it the way other people do. He is invincible, in fact, on that front, and will never show any cracks. I would go along with that. And maybe there's something admirable about that. Maybe some people relate to this guy just keeps coming back, doesn't he? But in terms of like relating on a financial level, obviously we're dealing with different amounts, and I think that's the argument you're making is, well, yeah, he's dealing with more money, but on that level, he's been willing to put it out there. I feel like a lot of that is just marketing. You know, it's a marketing of a persona. Trump's not very good at business, and he has made a reputation out of repeating over and over again that he is good at business. He's put his name on big buildings that were, some of them worked out and some of them were bad investments. But the reality is it's not something that anybody can replicate. And certainly somebody who wasn't protected at a young age from failure that would involve like actual threat to family and life and limb and starvation and these things, he's never faced anything like that. And if people see it that way, then they see it that way. But I find that a little thin. I just do.
I think that when you look at someone like Warren Buffett, who's, you know, infinitely richer than Donald Trump, you look at someone like, you know, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. You look at people who Americans in their optimism like identify with. They identify with the person who starts with little and ends up with something. And even though not all of them started with nothing, you know, I mean, they were in, you know, prestigious universities and things. And, you know, but even like the Sergey Brin and like the Google guys, you know, coming out of Stanford, they weren't, you know, you would never call them like underprivileged, but they also were not billionaires. I think people in the American culture, I think you begrudge that less. And I think when people look at like you've got more and like the haves and the have nots and all that, I think there's a nuance to the conversation that Trump kind of highlights, where it's really not, at the end of the day, I don't think people begrudge people how much they have. They begrudge them a little bit more about like how they got there. This is why a person like Mitt Romney, a person like, you know, the Kennedys, engender a different kind of reaction and a different kind of, if we want to call it political allegiance, than someone like Donald Trump does. I think the left in this country has been baffled by why do poor people identify with Donald Trump? And it's not because he flies around a plane and goes to a golf course and, you know, and it's not because he tweets and curses and what have you, talks like them. I think they actually like identify with the notion that here's like a guy who risks stuff as opposed to a Mitt Romney. Who doesn't?
I think they like his confidence.
That might be part of it. That might be part of it.
More than his risks have.
But the idea that like if we went to the mill or we went to the mines and we said, you know, would you rather have a beer with George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, or Donald Trump? I think even before Donald Trump runs for president, they say Donald Trump. And it's not because he's a reality TV star or anything. I think it's because, like, yeah, this is a guy that I feel like I could relate to, you know.
Well, and I, not to put you on the spot, because we are three white people sitting here, but this is, of course, also, these are all white men that you are talking about,
sure,
all these stories, you know. So if you look at, was the left attracted to Barack Obama? For his building himself into who he became on his, you know, he didn't start with millions, did
no,
he?
No, I actually think that the opposite. I think conservatives I think that that plurality in the middle, that American wave that backed Barack Obama, could identify with him because of that.
Okay.
And it was very different, because if he had gone to Harvard Law and done some of like the things that he had done, but come from a privileged place, you know, even as an African American, I don't think people would have identified with him near as much. Bill Clinton is another example of someone who Rhodes Scholar, went to Yale, what have you, but came from like relative obscurity. Mm-hmm. That's an American story, you know, of people who like risked mm-hmm. something. And I think people could identify with Barack Obama that way. I think if he starts from, you know, I realize that there are fewer aristocratic African-Americans coming out of the 50s and 60s. So the narrative is a little bit more difficult. But say he were today to be like Oprah's kid, you know, 20 years from now to go on to be, I don't think that that the story is the same. I don't think that the narrative is the same. And I don't think that working class people identify with that in the same way.
I don't know. You just mentioned Bush, Romney, and Trump, all of whom are, you know, scions of multi-generational big business. All of their fathers were a big deal, and their grandfathers too. And you just mentioned Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who grew up with single moms. And yeah, they all went to fancy schools for different reasons. And I'm not putting any of them on some kind of moral scale. I'm not saying that the Democrats are good and the Republicans are bad. I don't even know that. But I just think I don't buy the notion that you relate because they risked their daddy's millions. I don't. In fact, if anything, I don't know that that is anything at all. You know, one of the people I would point out is John Kennedy. Another example. Now, he's a Democrat who came from a well-connected family, unlike the ones we had just mentioned. But he was identified at the time as kind of this champion of the people. The Kennedy brothers were compared. Who are those Roman guys? The two brothers who were killed. Tributes of the plebes.
Caius Gracchus.
The Gracchus brothers. Mm-hmm. They were like that. Those kind of characters. These privileged people who came out and fought for the lower classes because that was the right thing to do, and. I think the intent, and I think any popularity Trump has with the working poor, for instance, the folks we're talking about, has more to do with the response to his message, whatever part of his message they like. And different people like different parts. Sometimes they just feel like somebody who doesn't talk like all the other talking heads on TV is enough.
See, I agree with you. I'm not trying to make like a moral case for why Trump is a great person. I'm not
getting that either. I'm just
The thing that I'm trying to explore is like why do people who are working class identify with Trump, to the like disillusionment of people who are not working class? Like these people, how can you say he represents you? And I think in a way that someone like a Bernie Sanders does not, in a way that someone who you know, has not risked things the way that Donald Trump has. I do think there's a certain authenticity that comes from that, you know, let me frame it like this. I think it is lazy to say, well, you know, Trump gives the code messages of racism and the code messages of xenophobia, and the lower classes pick up on that, and that's how they talk. So it's like gutter talk, and that's why they're drawn to him. I find that like not only demeaning, and I'm not suggesting that Aaron has said that, but you know, that's a common trope. I've not only find that demeaning, I find it like wholly inaccurate. I think that Trump is a billionaire. He has less in common with you and me than practically anybody in government today. But I think the one thing that does give him a bit of authenticity among the poor is that he has risked everything. He has lost everything. Even though, yes, he started from a more privileged place than most of us ever will, he ran the risk of total ruin. And I do think that gives him a certain amount of credibility that your typical person stepping up to plate doesn't have. Your you know, John Kennedy doesn't have, your Bernie Sanders doesn't have, your, you know, standard college professor doesn't have. And if you're searching for why people believe in him, people who you look at and say, like, you know, you have nothing in common with this guy. Yeah, they do. I think that's what it is.
I'm left with the question, what do you do when people believe something that's not true? And that is that Donald Trump was a good businessman.
That's fine. And I'm... You know,
because if that's true, and I just want to say, I've been listening very closely and trying to follow this, Chuck. I really have. I think that you don't
let me answer.
I think
it this
that there's all a spectrum of things right. that set people off. That and some of it was just what they thought of Hillary Clinton, and some of it was what they thought of the world, and some of it is that they like Trump about this or that or the other thing. But it's not just one thing, and I kind of find it thin.
Let me answer that this way, because I do think that one of the things we do as humans is we create back narratives. Warren Buffett must be a brilliant person because he started like selling soda pop on the corner and became a millionaire or a billionaire. Bill Gates must be like a genius because he started with nothing in his garage and built this company, Microsoft. Now, I think that those are very compelling, and there's no one, I'm never going to argue that these are not really smart people, that genius people. But for every one like genius Bill Gates, there's 1,000 or more like geniuses who started from like very similar places, but like all the things didn't stack up. And they didn't reach that.
We don't account for luck.
We don't account for luck at all. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a great book about this. I'm struggling to think of the name right now, but Outliers, it's called.
Yeah, I've read that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, the first chapter about the hockey players and how, like, you go to the NHL hockey players and almost all the great players are born in the first 3 months of the year. Why? Because when they start hockey, when they're 4 years old, they're a year older than the kid born in December. And when the difference between a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old is huge in terms of their dexterity and their ability to play hockey. So all of a sudden, the ones born in January, February, March are identified as great hockey players, very young, when they're actually just like developmentally 9 months older than the other kids. That's a luck. You were born in the beginning of the year. Wayne Gretzky is a great hockey player of all time. He was also born, I think, in February. So, you know, how many Wayne Gretzky's are there who are born in October and November who don't get the same level of training and attention and what have you from an early age because they weren't, you know, they weren't the big kid in the ice rink. When you look at success, I think as humans, we want to create this backstory of it. And all I'm suggesting is that when we create the backstory of a Warren Buffett or the backstory of a Bill Gates or the backstory of a Donald Trump, yes, there's a ton of luck. You do not have to be, in the case of Donald Trump, like the most genius businessmen ever to get, there's plenty of business people with greater aptitude and greater skill than Donald Trump. He's not a genius because he's a billionaire. But that like narrative, that trajectory is very different than the trajectory or the narrative of the person who goes to school and gets an engineering degree and comes and works in your city as an engineer for years and, you know, has a 401k. I'm pointing out myself. The person who goes and becomes a college professor and has like the nice living. The person who, you know, inherits the millions and goes on to do public service because that's what rich people do. It is a very different narrative. And I think it's a narrative that working class people can relate to.
Whether or not it's true?
Whether or not it is true. Whether or not it's any basis in reality, whether it's 99% luck or 1% luck. I think that the backstory people can relate to. And the reason I'm pushing on this and harping on this is not because I think it's like important that it be true. I think it's important that the people who dismiss it grasp it. I think that in this country, one of the things that is really messed up with our national dialogue right now is the tendency to dismiss Trump as, you know, he's not that smart. He's not that good. He's not a good businessman. He did, you know, he doesn't represent you. He's not, because I think what happens is we dismiss a whole lot of stuff that is real about the people who support him. It's another way of, like, you know, putting people in their place. Oh, you're a Trump supporter. Well, you know, don't get this, or you're not smart. You haven't figured it out, or he's fooling you, or what have you. And I'm not suggesting that Aaron's doing that. I mean, I think Aaron is a lot closer to real Trump voters than 99% of people who talk about this subject. So I'm not, you know, trying to impugn you in any way. But I think as a general broad narrative, when we do that, we miss something. The other thing I think happens is that we tend to, in doing that, almost debase our narrative down to that level. The whole concept of the resistance is that, you know, Trump is illegitimate and we'll treat him illegitimately. And in that way, you know, we'll push back on this evil that is Donald Trump. And I think that that is actually like the liberal analog of fake news. I think the way that you delegitimize Trump is by calling him Mr. President, by standing up there and asking him like legitimate policy questions, by treating him like the office that he's in. And then he's in that situation, he's kind of a clown, right? I mean, I do think, like, at the end of the day, what he has done is he has turned all of his opponents into the ludicrous circus of which he is the ringmaster. And I think if you actually want to restore the dialogue in this country, you have to A, understand his supporters and respect them, and then B, not stoop to that level of dialogue and actually continue to talk about things as like adults. I just went on like a 5-minute rant, so I apologize for that. But
this may not matter at all, but I'm just curious what you think. So if this is part of the phenomenon of the Trump voter, of President Donald Trump, did they know they were tapping into this? Is this luck that they tapped into this?
Who? Donald Trump?
Yeah.
I think it's like a roll of the dice luck.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, okay. This is like the history, you know, theory of history. Is history like macro forces, or is history like the great man? And I'm of the mindset that history is macro forces, and every now and then, like the great man, and in our modern age, it's the great woman, and, you know, hopefully like a diversity of voices, right? But like the great person rises up amongst that. If you look at as the quintessential 1930s Germany, you had someone on the right who rose up and like overcame the craziness on the left in Weimar Germany and took control of that. In, you know, World War I Russia, you had forces on the left that came up, and you had like the charismatic leader who emerged from that. I think it just as easily could have come the other way, the other side. It in a sense, like that's the roll of the dice, the spin of the dice. I don't think Donald Trump is like some mastermind, you know, I don't think there's some like genius that went into this. I think that, you know, the same with Hitler. I don't think there was any, or Lenin, or, you know, I think if you talk with someone like Mao Zedong, who it took decades to build this, is very different than these leaders that kind of stepped into a void. I think Donald Trump stepped into a void, was essentially like by luck in that void, like a guy who could ride that wave, and finds himself the president of the United States. In the same way that Vladimir Lenin stepped into a void with the downfall of the Tsar and the revolution, you know, in 1918 in World War I, and essentially rode that to being the leader of a Soviet Union.
It's all I can see you thinking.
Well, I got a lot of ways I can go with this. And I want to start by saying I'm not going to sit here and write on Trump voters. I've talked to a lot of them, as Chuck points out. You know, I live in a Trump precinct, in a Trump county, in a Trump legislative district, in a Trump congressional district. So
I think you live this more than I do, even.
Yeah. So, and I know a lot of people, including not, maybe not quite half, but my family used to be kind of 70-30 Democratic, and almost half of them voted for Trump, just going off of my extendeds and stuff. So I've been around this, and I don't want to sit here and ride on people. The words I heard a lot was, what choice did I have? That was a question I got back quite a bit. And I, you know, as a professor, you know, who's living the life that I live, perhaps I don't quite see that as, I don't feel that personally, but I'm going to go ahead and accept it as a premise. You know, they didn't feel like things were going to get better with Clinton, and they didn't know whether things would get better with Trump, but it was worth the chance. It was worth a shot. Is generally speak, and I could, I don't, I'm sure there's other people who have other ideas, but for a lot of the Trump voters I've talked to, that's kind of where it's at. And I don't know that they, I think there's an image behind Trump, going back to the show The Apprentice. That's how most people really know him. It was a very popular show. I watched it, never knowing the man would be my president someday, but I watched, my wife and I sat like chumps, and watched the most popular show in the country, which was The Apprentice, and we cared who got fired. We watched Omarosa before, before it was cool.
You were hoping Sinbad made it through.
No, I didn't. I checked out after they went to celebrities. But so there was an image. It wasn't about liking Trump. He was a jerk. He was supposed to be. That was the character. He was a wrestler. He's like Jesse Ventura was our governor. He was a villain as a wrestler. And those were the best wrestlers because they could do whatever. And it was awesome. And you could throw things at them and you could hit them in the head with a beer bottle and they didn't care. You know, it was beautiful. And I think Trump kind of filled that role. And it was the image of Trump getting off the plane, you know, money, 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 that whole thing. And that idea that he conveyed this confidence that, like, you know what? I don't know what's going on in Washington, but why don't we send a professional wrestler in there and body slam some folks, you know, and just see what happens. And I think there was a strong sense of that. And I'm not going to sit here and say you're dumb for doing that and you shouldn't do it. I'm not even, because I don't even know that I think I understand that. I think I understand that feeling quite well. But I am also, you know, I guess privileged, lucky would be how I would put it. I was raised poor, like Chuck and a lot of folks here, and I found my way to college and all this, and I took an interest in the stuff, and that was just my personality, and that's how I was born. And when I read about Trump's history, and I read, I'm not talking about the political press of today, when I read about what he did in real estate, what kinds of a business partner he was, everybody who touches him from his old days to now eventually is ruined. Financially, personally, his personal relationships, the way he treats people. I'm a public speaking professor, teacher, and I teach what Quintilian said, which is a good speaker is, and I'll modernize what he said. A good speaker is a good person speaking well. Four words, good person speaking well. Speaking well is the part we often focus on. And to some extent, I think Trump speaks well to what people want to hear, they respond to what he has to say. But that good person, I always have to lecture about when we talk about the great speakers and people say Hitler, you know, because Hitler got people to change, you know, and go march in a line and conquer the world. And yeah, it wasn't right. And they did all these horrible things, but he sure was a good speaker. And I say, you know what? He was, when you're not coming from a position of ethical balance and fairness to the people you work with and deal with and honesty, then you're not a speaker, you're a manipulator. And that's what Hitler was. And I'm going to leave it to people to make up their own mind. A lot of people didn't believe that about Trump. They don't think he's a manipulator. And if that's what you believe, if you're listening to this, that's fine. But just hold that standard out as you watch this play out and make up your own mind about who is speaking with good intent. And I'm not saying that my side always has it right, but I'm saying that I think that's what we've lost here, is we've gotten caught up in a world of imagery and marketing and flashing lights. And these people say that, and those people say that, and maybe we don't like any of it because it's too bright and flashy. It has nothing to do with intellect. It has to do with what the capacity of a human mind is to comprehend a very complicated world. I struggle with it as much as somebody who has never been to college would struggle with it. But that's what we're struggling with.
I think it's the opposite. I actually think that we intuitively comprehend a complicated world. What we have is we've not been distracted. We've just been reduced. We've been reduced to this. And in a sense, I think what we're seeing is, and you know, I was the first one to bring up 1930s Germany here. I know, like, it's a cheap thing to start talking about Hitler,
but it comes up a lot.
It does come up a lot. I when I look at like the Hitler phenomena, I think that we're wrong when we say, you know, he was a great speaker, he was captivating. He in a void, in a chaotic void, and I'll draw this to today. We have spent a year and a half now on this show talking about issues that are unsolvable, or at least unsolvable in like the current paradigm. Like, we have to make some tough choices. When you're talking about local government aid, some cities are going to go away. Some cities are not that exist today are not going to exist. Some roads that you have are never going to be fixed. That's like an existential, really hard problem. And when you can't deal with that problem, when you have problems that are unsolvable within your cultural paradigm, what you do is you make a path for people who are not serious about solving them, but are serious about like other things. And I think that's both on the left and the right. And one of the fears that I have today is not that, you know, we're going to have another 4 years of Donald Trump. I think that may happen. One of the fears that I have today is that we're going to get the left analog of that. You know, we're going to have like two really crazy bad choices to deal with, because we are just incapable of solving some existential problems that I don't think are easily solvable.
And I'll join you. I know we like to end on a note of agreement. I'm going to join you with we have at least so far been unable to address these impossible, quote unquote, impossible problems. I don't think they're impossible, but the problem is, in a democratic society, you have to convince a majority to buy a complicated solution to a complicated problem. And the only way to do that is to sell it as a simple idea. The problem with that is simple ideas can sometimes be solutions to complicated problems, and other times they can be snake oil.
Let's just put one little nuance on that.
I'm not putting a right or a left on the snake oil.
No, totally. I totally hear you. But I think in a centralized decision-making framework, that's in a democratic society, that's what you have to do. In a pre-Minnesota Miracle framework, the cities of the Iron Range can figure things out for themselves in a different way and adapt and change.
Yeah, they got millions of bucks coming
in
from the mines.
No, they don't. Yeah. But they also don't have the liabilities, you know.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the nuance, is that what we have done in our quest to make things equal and fair, in our quest to streamline the economy and create efficiencies, what we've done is we've globalized and centralized all aspects of our economy and political decision making. And what we find is that works really well in the short term. In the long term, it creates these existential problems that are really hard to solve at that level.
And I would just think, I come back to it, we live in a marketing age, and marketing is so powerful on psychology, on the way people think, and it's marketing is successful on everybody, not just one educational class, not just one political party or another.
No, you just sing the money, money, money song when Donald Trump goes down the stairs.
But that's what I mean.
Yeah.
It was effective. It was effective as a way of understanding someone. And in that world where marketing provides these easy answers to what do I need, I think I might like a new car. I got a thing in the mail the other day that, because I get my car serviced at a dealership, and they tell me, you know, look at this car. For just a little bit more money than you're paying, you could get this car, you know?
Fancier
and I
stuff.
Didn't want a car, but for a second there, I kind of wanted a car. And I think when we talk about our politics, somebody is coming along and they're saying, you know, hey, you know, this, you know, yeah, we're going to end up deporting some people, or yeah, we're going to have to raise taxes to do this. You know, I'm speaking of two different sides of the political, you know, we're going to have to do something that maybe you don't quite like, but think about this world that we're going to make that's pretty nice. You know, you could be a part of that world. And we respond to that politically. I think both sides do. And that's why I will share the concern that both parties are clearly moving to their extremes. It's very clear in the primaries. You know, it happened here in Minnesota. It's happened everywhere. There's only a handful of cases where some moderate maverick has pulled through here.
Walls is about as close as you're going to get.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
today's politics, and I'm. You know, I'm undecided as to...
And then Politico call him a boring white guy the next day.
Right. Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. He's disqualified on those accounts.
Well, I want to say a couple of things. We ran out of time. I wanted to hear about both of you took the quintessential family vacations,
oh, yeah.
road trips. That would have been cool, but we can maybe talk about that another time. But I did want to mention some of the things that came to be this whole conversation came out of not having the gubernatorial thing.
Yeah.
Lots of people wrote in, and someday soon, let's talk about economics and how towns get new people to come to town. And daycare came up from a number of people, mm-hmm. and they said, please, please, please ask these candidates about that. That was one of the things. I just want to mention some of the things. Clean water, a lot of water stuff came up, and people really wanted to know what the candidates thought of that. And I also want to say, we would love to hear from you. I know Chuck is part of the Strong Towns podcast that you do. A lot of times you're talking to, people are sending in questions to you. And that would be a great thing for us too with Dig Deep, is if you sent in your questions to us, and that might be part of our extra podcast, or mm-hmm. who knows, maybe be a full topic for it. You never know. But we want to hear from you, whether that is on social media or you send us an email, comments@kexc.org. And I just want to brag a little bit on my friends here. You should pay attention to the things they're doing in their real jobs. Aaron at Minnesota Brown, his blog, and then strongtowns.org, where you can read the blog and hear the podcast and all that kind of stuff, where they're doing good work in the world. So thanks for being here, you guys. Thanks for digging deep.
Yeah, thanks,
Heidi. I think we made a pretty good thing out of a canceled event.
I just want to say, and I want to put it on the record, that you folks don't know how good a debate Heidi here had prepared for you. and it was Heidi at the hub, and it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I was even going to give him water.
Yeah, yeah. She had everything mm-hmm, figured mm-hmm. out. So
We'll get it someday.
With candidates, it'll be a beautiful thing.
Well, as always, when you learn something, it's because it was a little bit difficult, but I did learn a lot in this whole process. So.
I'll throw this out, and you can delete this if you don't want.
Okay.
This is part of the extra.
Oh, boy.
I do wonder if our House candidates wouldn't want to do this.
For District 8?
Yeah.
Radenovich and Stauber?
Yeah. I mean, that's
Sandman.
Really like the election, mm-hmm. and that's the one that, you know, I think nationally people are looking at too, and I think that one... I'm not going to say that the governor's race is not consequential. I think it is consequential, but I don't think it maybe is going to have the consequence that the 8th district will have.
Okay. Well, I won't throw that out. I'm just going to wait a week till I think about that, because we're still in the week where we got canceled. So.
Right. You still have the mourning period. You're still in denial. You've passed denial. You're in like a stage of grief. What is it? Anger? Then
yes. Yeah. I'm going to tell you, though, people are so nice. I mean, they are worried about me because I've been talking about it for a year.
I know.
On the air, too. And so it's really very sweet. People who don't know me.
And not just at work, like in casual conversation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the funny thing is about this, and I haven't heard you guys use this phrase, but it's really, you know, when a phrase keeps popping up that you realize is suddenly the new hot phrase?
Yeah.
This is not new and hot, but I would say 95% of the people's response to me, people I know well, people I don't know well, they all looked at me and they said, what a bummer. Everybody used that same phrase. And I was like, well, I think it's a little more than a bummer, but why are you saying bummer? But anyway, it was just a little odd. I noticed that.
I think that we should vote independent, libertarian, and green. Just as a protest.
No, I think it's, I don't know if there is no independent, and it's there's the grassroots.
There's the
marijuana.
Like legalized
the marijuana. Yeah. One of us has to vote marijuana.
I will say that I am still a Pollyanna. I still believe like this could possibly happen, or we could do the District 8 or something like that. And I still want people to go vote whoever you want to vote for on November 6th is our election day.
Yeah.
So that's the way I am. I'm always optimistic.
And I'll just add something I observed from just you did a lot of election coverage right before the primary.
You too,
and
yes.
And I did too. And one of the comments I got, and I'm sure you got it too, Heidi, was people want to know about these candidates.
They did.
And a lot of times our traditional media is doing a a poor job of explaining the basic things like, what is the difference between these candidates? Do they have policy differences? Do they have credential differences? What is the difference? And typically, like on the nightly news, the local news, or even in the newspaper, if you get a newspaper, if your small town has a newspaper still, they see the names of the candidates, they see the candidates advertising, but they don't know, just they don't get a chance to size up these candidates. And so I was
surprised by, I mean, I figured, you know, kind of people, fans of KEXE would appreciate the District 8 coverage I did like right before the primary, but it was people on Twitter, people were really responsive to that. And I think it was because you were asking them questions and giving them some time, and they're in their own voice. And the way that I do election interviews, I polish up nobody. Like, I polish us up a lot before I run it on the air, because really? We're not running for office. So
she does. We always sound smarter than we really are.
But I do not change one word of what a politician might say, even if they sneeze in the interview. And I think it's important. They people, you know, sometimes it's as little as the voice, the sound of the voice, or how they communicate what they have to say about something. I mean, we would all wish there would be substance as well that you judge it on, but something about radio, because it's only voice and it's not what they look like, that I think people listen to.
Voice goes
to
your, straight to your head.
Radio is so intimate. I mean, I have people all the time who I've never met. I have no idea who they are, who come up to me and say, you know, either on my own podcast on Strong Towns or on, you know, Dig Deep with KXE, you know, oh, you're Chuck Murray. Like, it's like we're best friends. And it's, they feel like they know me, and I've, you know, never met these people at all. It took me a while to get used to that, but it's really cool.
Yeah. And I, you know, we've gotten a lot of great response to Dig Deep in the time that we've been doing it, but I would say I was surprised by the response we were getting before this governor's debate, how many people really have been paying attention to this statewide as well. And I didn't realize that. So that's pretty cool.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I mean, when I listened to the Johnson Pawlenty, they did a radio interview on Minnesota Public Radio. And it was the first time that I'd heard the former governor in a long time.
No, yeah. Sorry.
No, it's the first time I'd heard the former governor in a long time. And I was so disappointed, really. Just in like the churlish kind of way that he dealt with some of the legitimate, you know, the questions.
Well, and I don't know if I said it in this recording, but I was really disappointed in some of what happened on Almanac, their first head.
Yeah, no, totally.
And that they started with really a question about the Keith Ellison thing. I just thought,
come on.
That's the most important thing in our state right now.
No, it's the most important thing if you're part of the hashtag fake news.
All right. Thanks, guys.